TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
A quarter century of unheeded warnings. Remembering Stephen Schneider. When the Stanford professor Stephen Schneider died on a return flight from a climate conference in Sweden in 2010, the world lost one of the great and courageous climate scientists. He and Professor James Hansen risked their careers by researching and publishing on the risks of climate change since the 1980s. And the world would be a very different place today had their warnings been heeded instead of denied and disparaged. In December 2012, James Hansen received an award in Stephen Schneider's name for outstanding climate science communications. This radio program, in turn, is a tribute to Schneider. Over a period of 7 years, he gave me time for interviews when no other scientist I could find was willing to go on the record with such expertise and conviction. This conversation was recorded in the garden of his home near the Stanford campus. Schneider had just returned from his work with the IPCC. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was established in 1988 by two United Nations organizations, the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations Environment Program, and later endorsed by the UN General Assembly. The IPCC does not carry out its own research or monitoring. Thousands of scientists are making contributions, which are reviewed by the IPCC, and then must be approved line by line by all member nations. Typically, this involves the governments of more than 120 countries. The US, China, Saudi Arabia, among others, often exercise their veto rights over final publication. Schneider's work on the IPCC deserves praise, both for the quality of his own research that had to stand up to such unheard-of scrutiny, as well as for his patience. He was a dedicated author on all four IPCC assessments. Schneider was looking forward to his new role as coordinating lead author on the fifth assessment report, scheduled for 2014 when he died in 2010. When I spoke to him in 2001, Schneider had just co-authored the report of the Working Group 2 of the IPCC, assessing how vulnerable natural and human systems are to climate change. In my introduction to the 2001 program, I began by summarizing the findings of that IPCC report.
For a few days in January of 2001, some media carried information about recent findings on global warming. There's no longer any doubt that the world is indeed warming at an unprecedented rate. Snow cover and ice have receded, global average sea levels have risen, and the impact of climate change is now visible in nature, plants, and animals. The findings come from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. Three working groups each issued a multi-page report, as well as a 20-page summary that is available on the web. The report states that present levels of CO2, the major greenhouse gas, have not been seen on Earth for the past 420,000 years, likely not during the past 20 million years. Three-quarters of the CO2 in the atmosphere comes from fossil fuel burning in power plants and automobiles. CO2 is long-lived, several centuries after emissions occur. About a quarter of the CO2 is still present in the atmosphere. A universal recommendation is to go back, at the minimum, to 1990 levels of CO2 and immediately work on reducing all greenhouse gases from that level. Even though the US produces 25% of the world's greenhouse gases, President Bush, in March of this year, reneged on his campaign promise to reduce CO2. The economy of a superpower, he said, comes first. This interview with Professor Stephen Schneider was recorded a few days before Bush went back on his promise.
The one belief you have to have as a scientist is that all things you believe might be wrong, and therefore you have to continuously re-examine the evidence to make sure it's what you thought it was before, to find out if it's weaker or stronger. And that's precisely what literally hundreds of authors and 1,000 reviewers did in the connection with the recent IPCC, and they reaffirmed that not only were previous assessments that humans were mixed up in the game correct, but they were even more deeply embedded than we thought, and a new revelation in the recent IPCC. And they said, not only is the effect of human activities discernible in the records of climate, but the climate change of the past few decades, which is very large relative to anything that we can imagine from looking just at history, the climate change of the last few decades is now discernible in the movements of plants and animals and ice, and that therefore there's now a clear impact of recent climate change on nature.
Can we start with ice? Because in our last interview, we talked about that a little bit. And I wondered if you had followed the retraction of glaciers and the melting of ice in your work and could describe that.
Most of the glaciers in the world, not all, are receding. So remember, the glaciers are growing in the winter and diminishing in the summer. And the question is, who wins, losing in the summer or building in the winter? And for the vast majority of glaciers in the world, over the past 150 years or so, they've been getting smaller. But it's a radical increase in the rate of shrinkage for most glaciers, especially tropical ones, in the last few decades. And that's completely new and was not expected. And although it's a circumstantial piece of evidence, that is, how do we know that some other factor isn't doing it, the probability is fairly high that when you look at all the glaciers around and you look at the fact that the thermometers of the world are rising to higher levels than they've been in 1,000 years, that this is not just an accident. And when you look at the preponderance of evidence, it seems that the glaciers are telling the story that the world is warming, but our thermometers already told us that story. The glaciers are now just reflecting it.
Maybe we should step back for a moment and talk about these temperature readings that have been published in this report and you have been working on. Can we do a thumbnail sketch of temperature records and then go back to the glaciers?
Sure. Over the 20th century, the average surface temperature of the Earth has increased something on the order of 0.6 degrees Celsius, around a degree Fahrenheit. And we know that that's consistent in most, but not all, parts of the world. There are a few places that actually got a little bit cooler, but not much. So global warming, and this sounds radical, but in fact, it's completely easy. Global warming is a fact. Doesn't matter what you read in the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, they're just wrong. The existence of global warming is essentially established beyond doubt. That's not the debate. The debate is whether this 6/10 of a degree Celsius warming is just nature being perverse and rolling snake eyes on the dice, or whether we've loaded the dice and it's changing because of something that we did. That's a much tougher question, but one that IPCC also came out and said is likely to be at least half or maybe more due to us. And the reason they said that was due to four or five different lines of evidence, but one of the primary ones is the simple question, how unusual is 6/10 of a degree warming in a century? I mean, if it happens 3 and 4 times every millennium, well, then why would this one be unusual? And the only way you can know how often a century-long warming trend occurs over 1,000 years, say, is by having measurements of the temperature over 1,000 years. But that's not possible because the thermometer was only invented 400 years ago, and it's only been distributed around, you know, many far-flung places of the world for the last 100. So we got a real problem, which is we got this one warming trend, and we don't know whether it's unusual. The good news is Thermometers aren't the only thing that measure temperature. So does the thickness of the rings of trees. You know, every summer when the trees near tree line in the mountains, for example, grow, how thick their ring is depends upon how warm it is. The kinds of oxygen that are in water, there's a couple of kinds. There's a heavy oxygen 18 and there's a light oxygen 16. And the amount of that that gets incorporated into living shells like coral reef structure or clams or phytoplankton depends on the temperature. So we can go back and we can collect fossils of these now dead life or sometimes even living in the case of a coral, and we can analyze the chemical composition, and it gives us a proxy for a thermometer. It's a proxy thermometer. It's not an actual temperature, but it's proportional to temperature. Then we can take a look in lakes where pollen falls down, and if that pollen is from trees that like it hot, then will be more pollen of the hot kind. If it's from trees that like it cold, there'll be more pollen from the cold kind. So by looking at those proxies, we've been able to put together a record of the past 1,000 years. And it suggests that the past 50 years are off the charts. They are warmer than it's been in 1,000 years on a hemispheric scale. And therefore, the likelihood that that's a chance event is very small. When you combine that with the well-established greenhouse effect theory, which is the heat-trapping capability of the atmosphere, and you find the last few decades are unusual, and you find there's 30% more carbon dioxide and 150% more methane due to human activities, the combination of all these factors leads nearly all open-minded scientists to conclude that this is not just an accident.
Yeah, this page in the report, page 8, has these on top of each other, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, sulfur. They all show in the last few decades really a steep rise. And that rise coincides with the temperature graph on the previous page.
Those of us who've been studying this for decades have long said, I wrote in my 1976 book, that by the end of the century that we'd probably have demonstrable climate change from greenhouse gases and perhaps aerosols. And that wasn't, you know, such a prescient long view. It was based upon simple principles in physics which say that when you add gases to the atmosphere that trap heat, and when you trap heat near the surface, that things are going to get warmer. This is not a radical surprise. The radical surprise would be if things were not happening, because these are fundamental principles that are well established in science. The reason scientists are so reluctant to want to say things is that nature is very noisy, very bouncy. That is, there's lots of natural variability. And therefore, the debate isn't over whether we're pushing on the system. It's whether our push is hard enough to be heard and to be felt. And what IPCC said cautiously in 1995 is, yeah, it's discernible. And now they said, maybe we were conservative, it's really discernible. And added the new wrinkle, which is not only is the climate change discernible, but the impact of that climate change on nature is now discernible too.
So let's go back to the impact. We started talking about glaciers, ice caps. Is this story true about the lake that opened up at the North Pole?
The story about the North Pole actually is, on one hand, it amuses me. On the other hand, it makes me worry. The people who reported it, in particular, Jim McCarthy, who's a Harvard scientist, he mentioned he was going to take this Russian icebreaker to the North Pole. Now, this is not a science cruise, despite what the newspapers said. This was a Harvard alumni trip for which he was the professor going along. Well, when I did this in 1992, we had an interesting experience, because these icebreakers, even though these are 2 football field long ships, they still will cruise along at 15 miles an hour, and then they will hit a pressure ridge. That's where blocks of floating sea ice have crashed together, and they form a ridge that may be 30, 40 feet. This massive ship would slam to a stop, and those of us occasionally were lecturing to our tourist audience, and we'd get knocked off the stage. So I had warned Jim McCarthy to be careful on the stage. So I see him right before he did the press conference on this, and he had just come back from the pole, and he said, I didn't have that problem. I never got knocked off the stage. The ice was so slushy all the way up. And that was amazing to me that it had, you know, gone that far. And he said when we got to the pole, there was no ice. And I said, be careful on that one, because remember, the winds are always blowing and the ocean currents are always moving the ice apart. So the ice is separating. Any one time, even in a cold time, you have 10% of the Arctic Ocean uncovered because of just luck. It could have been at the North Pole, so don't make a big deal. He said, you're right, I won't make a big deal. The big deal was the slushy ride. That's what was really unusual. So they held a press conference. They talked all about the slushy ride, and by the way, there was no ice at the pole, and they didn't make a big deal of it, but the press did, and there were all these cartoons about Santa swimming around and all this other stuff.
So what about the slushy ride? What's the significance of the slushy ride?
The significance is that there's been a massive thinning, at least that season, and on that particular ship track, all the way from Murmansk in northern Russia up to the North Pole. And I think the probability that that's entirely chance is pretty low. I think that's connected to the overall thinning of ice that's been reported by satellites and submarines, that we're making a difference that is now becoming louder and more discernible on Earth.
The other criteria that you mentioned earlier, one was ice, glaciers, the other one was nature, animals, and plants. Let's go to that.
Well, we're sitting here listening to and looking at a number of birds, and they're a good example because some birds are residents and they hang around and they'll be here as long as they have resources. Now, those resources include the vegetation they need. So if the climate warms and the vegetation that they need is at the southern end of its range, it's going to move north, and those birds are going to have to move north with it. Supposing they need two kinds of vegetation, one to eat and one to nest in. If only one species of plant moves and the other one doesn't, that bird might be in trouble. The other thing, thinking about the birds we're listening to now, is that they lay their eggs in the spring, and there's a debate in the scientific community whether they cue their hormonal activity that makes them produce on day length, or is it something else, like temperature or the flowering of the trees that they need? And that debate is being partially answered because there are a number of species, not just in North America, but in Europe and in other parts of the world, that are now laying their eggs a week or two early over the past few decades compared to earlier in the century. And this is coincidental with places where it is warmer. In addition, some birds are coming back from their migration from the tropics earlier. And some butterflies have been moving up mountains and toward the pole, both in Europe and in North America. And marine communities that were further south are now moving in further north. And there are changes in the lifestyle of penguins. Those penguins that like sea ice have been doing poorer, and those that don't have been doing better in Antarctica. And the polar bear is an example, not of a bird, but of a very, very big and charismatic creature that people now believe may be severely threatened by that slushy Arctic, because if the sea ice is going to be thinner and disappear earlier and form later, those bears are going to be thinner. Remember, they feed by eating seals, by hiding in the sea ice when the seals come up through holes in the ice to breathe. That's how they catch them. And then when the bears catch the seal, then the foxes come and eat the carcass after that, and then the gulls. And that entire Arctic ecosystem is dependent upon sea ice. And already there are signs that the bears are starting to get into trouble, although the clearer signs are on birds and butterflies and marine systems and plants. All we can say from studying literally thousands of these records over the last 30 to 50 years is that the 0.6 degree global warming has been enough to start to show up in the environmental systems of the world, the plants, the animals, and the ice. That it would move in the direction expected is not surprising. That the 0.6 was enough to already create a statistically clear signal is what's interesting, because nobody expects us to be so lucky as to get away with only another 0.6. We're expecting 3 to maybe as much as 10 times more warming than that over the next 2 centuries. And that is going to be much more serious than just a discernible and noticeable change.
In your book, Laboratory Earth, you're talking about the scenario that we know from history that climate change has had an impact on plant and animal populations, and that they did move around in history. But for one, the change took place over much longer periods of time, and it wasn't that huge a degree change from zero to five.
Well, Mariah, you're exactly right that in the past, the average rates of change, if you think about the glaciers coming and going, is a degree per thousand years. And we're talking about if we were very, very, very lucky, another degree in a century. And if we're very unlucky, 6 degrees in a century. 6 degrees is the difference between an ice age and our current warm interglacial that takes nature 5 to 10,000 years to fully complete. And we'd be talking about a change on the order of 50 to 100 times faster. And it would be very difficult for most species to keep up for that with that rapid change without being scrambled. But there's an additional factor, which in some senses may be even worse. When the ice melted and the trees that are now in Canada or northern U.S., for example, were in central U.S. or southern U.S., they chased the ice sheet north. In the process, those ecosystems were radically changed. They're what we call no analog habitats. There were combinations of plants and animals unknown today that happened during that transition. And in fact, that was coincident with the extinction of the so-called charismatic megafauna, the saber-toothed cats and the large elephants and so forth. And the climate change combined probably with hunting pressures together led to those extinctions. But there was something very different than today. There were no factories, farms, freeways, and urban settlements to speak of 10, 15,000 years ago during that transition. Now we're talking about change, much more rapid change than occurred then, and we're talking about change through highly disturbed habitats, and most of wild nature now is getting fractionated into smaller and smaller patches and being forced to change across disturbed landscapes. It strikes me as virtually certain that we'll see increases in endangerment, in threats to species, and in extinctions through this combination of pressures that humans are putting on the land, both physically by chopping it down and modifying it, and climatically by using the atmosphere as a sewer to dump our wastes and getting the climate change as a consequence.
That's so unfathomable that people may want to deny it.
Well, denial helps us get through things, but denial's not very healthy if you hold on to it for very long. And the good news is this is not an absolutely insoluble problem. There was a third working group. And the working group three actually had embedded in it an optimistic message along with a pessimistic one. The pessimistic one is that people don't like to change, particularly if the change is going to cost them money in the short run. And another pessimistic message is the world is a pretty inequitable place and that there's a vast disparity in the quality of life between the poorer two-thirds and the richer one-third of people. And it's the richer people who use more energy and have done the bulk of the damage to the atmosphere so far, but that over the next few decades, that's going to switch as the now developing countries like India and China and Mexico and Indonesia become richer. If they repeat the Victorian Industrial Revolution with coal burning and internal combustion engines, they will actually swamp the emissions of the now rich countries. So there's an opportunity for a bargain where the rich countries who have, at the same time, they've been pretty bad planetary citizens, have high information capability and the capacity to develop technologies, solar machines and wind machines and highly efficient light bulbs and motors. The key is getting those products diffused throughout not only the economies in the current rich countries, but rapidly and at affordable prices transferred into the developing countries so that as they develop their economies, they don't go down the wrong branch point and set up a coal economy instead of initially a gas economy followed by a renewable economy. Those are choices that can be made now, but they involve international action for a whole new way of seeing the world. And it's, in a phrase, a cooperative world. Currently, everybody from the left and the right sees things from nationalistic viewpoints in general. They see things in competitive terms. You're always hearing what's going to happen to our competitive advantage. When we're talking about using the atmosphere as a sewer, that whole competitive phrase has no meaning because it's a commons. It's shared by everybody. And as a result of that, we have a common interest in its protection. Therefore, what we need to do is fashion cooperative solutions. And I think the very act of cooperating is so unusual to this planet that it's going to probably take us a generation just to experiment with how to do it. How do we make those technology transfers so that developing countries have a environmentally benign set of development props? If we turn around and tell them, no, you can't use coal and you can't use internal combustion engines, they say, hey, you guys use that to get rich in your dirty Victorian Industrial Revolution with sweatshops and low wages and smoke, you know, choked cities. And then you got richer and you improved your quality of life and got rid of some of those things. Now you've invented this global warming thing to deny us the chance to do the same thing. And there's a lot of paranoia and anger. Well, the world is an inequitable place, and we're not going to cure that inequity overnight. But what we need to do is make sure that the inequity doesn't push the poor nations to opposing climate protection measures, while at the same time the rich, so afraid it's going to lose its competitive advantage, isn't going to want to do it either. We need to get into that cooperative mode of thinking because we need to begin that 25-year experiment in how to cooperate if we're ever going to have any hope of preventing substantially dangerous change as the 21st century unfolds.
That was a rebroadcast of my 2001 Earth Day special and interview of the great late Dr. Stephen Schneider. He was professor in the Biological Sciences Department at Stanford University and former department director at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, Boulder, Colorado. Schneider is also coordinating lead author for the IPCC Climate Change Assessment Reports. Come back when TUC Radio returns for the last of my interviews with Schneider. We were then talking about his keynote address at the 2005 meeting of climate scientists at the Hadley Center in England. For the first time in the history of climate science, an interdisciplinary group of scientists openly addressed the value-laden question of avoiding dangerous climate change. And that meeting was organized by a government organization. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a CD of the tribute to Stephen Schneider by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.